Good day, everyone, everywhere, and special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places in Yahshua, Jesus, our Messiah. The name of this program is Cross the Border, and my name is Nicholas. We've been going through the Bible, and we've ended up in the book of Daniel. It took a couple days to talk about interpretation of the beasts and other symbols in both Daniel and Revelation, since the two books are so closely tied together in their symbols and their prophecy. Today we're going to jump back into Daniel, beginning at chapter 7 and verse 1. Before I do that, I'd like to invite you to visit my website. It's crosstheborder.org. And send me an email there just to let me know you're listening, or if you have any questions, comments, find the email link there and do send me an email. I would like to hear from you. Well, let's jump right in to Daniel chapter 7 and verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Now we have here a verse that tells us that he wrote the dream and he told the sum of the matters, which gives us a date for the book of Daniel and when it was written. I know that many so-called scholars and skeptics have come up in the last couple hundred years and have decided that Daniel's prophecies were just too good. They were just too accurate, that he could not have written them beforehand, that he must have written them after the fact. Now, these skeptics and critics, of course, they preclude the fact that there is a God, a creator, who can communicate with the men that he has created and tell them the future, even in the cryptic sense of these prophecies. So even the skeptics realize the value and the accuracy of Daniel's prophecies, so much so that they just don't want to believe that he wrote these things before the fact, but they wrote them after the fact. I don't want to get into that argument today, but I do want to address it just briefly. The skeptics have been answered, and there's a lot of problems with the conclusions that they come to. So if you want to look into that, you can look up dating Daniel in any search engine and look into that for yourself and come to your own conclusion. But if you love the truth, the conclusion that you'll come to is the skeptics have more problems in dating Daniel later than the believers do in dating Daniel earlier. Anyway, Daniel records it here for us that it was the first year of Belteshazzar when he had the dream, and he wrote the dream, and he told the sum of the matters. And of course, he told that in his writing. In verse 2, Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and beheld, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. Now we've learned, and we were discussing through our interpretation, that of course the sea represents many people, and the winds striving upon the sea means that there is tumult, wars, and there's a lot of strife between the peoples of the nations on the earth, and that's basically what we have here. And he continues, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. So we know that these, and the word diverse, of course, is an old English word that people don't use very much today, though it is still in use today and it still means the same thing. Actually, most people would say different. Diverse one from another means that they were very different from one another, meaning that they weren't the same because they had different origins. And we'll see that it wasn't one beast that had one origin that kept morphing into something else. No, but they were different from one another. They had different origins, and that's why they're represented by four different beasts. Verse 4, The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. And I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So, that's a very graphic picture. You have a lion, it has eagle's wings, the wings were plucked off, and then it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet as a man. So you have a lion that has reared up on its hinds like a man and stands, and a man's heart was given to it. And Daniel's seeing this picture, a very graphic picture. And he continues, and I beheld, in verse 5, another beast, a second, like to a bear. It raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. So another very graphic image there. A bear raised up on one side. It has three ribs in its mouth and between its teeth. And they said, whoever they are, to it, arise, devour much flesh. So that's what's being said to the bear. And after this, so there's a definite separation between each one of these beast images that Daniel's receiving in this dream that he wrote down, and he's telling us the sum of the matters, as he said. So after this, I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And then after this, I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceedingly. So this was exceedingly strong. And it had great iron teeth, and devoured and broke in pieces, and it stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. So it was different. This beast, all the other beasts were different from one another, but somehow this one was different than the other three before it. So it was diverse from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn. So we have 10 horns, and then there's a little horn that came up among them. So somehow the other horns are big in comparison, so because he notes that this is a little horn. So what does that mean? We'll have to discuss that too. And he says, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. So you have 10 horns, three are plucked up by the roots, and he continues, and behold, in this horn, speaking of the little horn, before whom three were of the first horns were plucked up by the roots, were the eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Well, let's stop there for a minute, and let's go back and look at each of these beasts here in succession. The lion, that's the first beast. Is that the first beast? Let me go back here and back up, and we'll just jump back and do each one. Four beasts. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. So that's the one we're going to discuss first. The lion of Daniel 7 was no ordinary lion because it had the wings of an eagle on its back. Real lions, of course, do not have eagle's wings. So clearly, this is a symbol of some type. The four beasts of Daniel 7 parallel the four kingdoms of Daniel 2, if you'll remember, as we went through Daniel 2. And of course, we're speaking of the dream of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had, which Daniel was able to retell to Nebuchadnezzar and then give the interpretation of. So we find that the Daniel 7, the four beasts parallel the four kingdoms of the beast image from Nebuchadnezzar's dream. So it is logical that the first beast that Daniel saw, the lion, corresponds to the head of gold on the image in Daniel 2, which we are told represented Nebuchadnezzar. We are also told that each metal represented a kingdom. Therefore, the lion Daniel saw represented both Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. So the question is, why are there eagle's wings on the back of this lion? Well, there's several reasons why eagle's wings appear on the back of the lion. To understand these reasons, it is worthwhile to do a bit of study of the symbolism involved. And we spent a couple days looking at that. An eagle is a predatory bird that will attack suddenly from the air. Though their prey is often on the ground, sometimes they attack other birds in flight, perhaps killing them in the process. In addition, eagles in particular tend to spend a lot of time soaring high in the sky, gaining lift from rising thermal currents of air that can carry them upwards. And, you know, this gets into the characteristics principle that we talked about, one of the principles that we talked about over the last couple days when we were discussing these principles. So we want to look into the characteristics. Why are there eagle's wings specifically on the back of this lion? So we have to look at an eagle to see why. Such birds can often rise far above other birds. They have very good eyesight. They can easily spot an attack opportunity from far away. The wings on the lion therefore represent that this animal easily spotted an attack opportunity and took advantage of it. In Daniel and Revelation, winds can represent a commotion among the nations of the world, like wars and rumors of wars. Familiar. So the winds, through warfare, it shows the striving of the four winds upon the waters. And we saw that in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 2. Thermal uplifts are the winds in motion in an upward direction. So this shows that the Babylonians were able to ride the commotion among the nations of the world and rise above the rest of them through warfare so as to be able to gain control of them. The eagle's wings represent Babylon soaring above the other nations, and because of this, it would be able to attack at will whenever it spotted an opportunity. Of course, that cannot be literal, because nations do not literally soar in the air like a bird. To correctly understand this means it is well to remember that the angel explained to Daniel that the beasts are four kings. So one beast should correspond with one king. Therefore, we know that the characteristics of soaring into the air apply to the leader of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. This represents that the leader of Babylon was a smarter man than his contemporaries, and as a result, he would be ahead of their game, whatever it was, and would win military victories against them where others would be more likely to fail. He would be more successful in taking advantage of opportunities provided by the unrest among the nations around him than anyone else, which would allow him to rise above the opposition, certainly eagle-like for this reason. We do know from history that Babylon was very successful in creating and expanding its kingdom. Much of this was owed to the military genius of Nebuchadnezzar. He knew a good attack opportunity when he saw one and moved to take advantage of it wherever possible. He suffered few setbacks in his military campaigns. The eagle's wings also represent that God was involved in directing the affairs of nations. God controlled events so as to make Babylon a kingdom, and says that he gave the kingdom of Babylon to Nebuchadnezzar. Here's we have that evidence from the scripture. And we have here in Exodus 19:4, it says, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." So anyway, that's something that we may consider there. Yahuwah, God, directly involved himself in bringing the Israelites out of Egypt, because it was his power and action that brought them freedom from the Egyptians. The direct action of God created the nation Israel. In Exodus 19:4, the eagle's wings symbolize the direct involvement of God in the affairs of Egypt so as to create the nation of Israel. In like manner, in Daniel 7, eagle's wings can symbolize God's direct involvement in bringing about the Babylonian kingdom, which God gave to Nebuchadnezzar years before the vision occurred that is recorded in Daniel 7. Daniel had said this directly to Nebuchadnezzar when he was given the dream of the image recorded in Daniel chapter 2. And if you'll remember what Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, he said, "You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory." And we have that from Daniel chapter 2 and verse 37. In the vision recorded in Daniel 7, as Daniel watched the lion, he said that the wings of the lion were plucked off, and it was made to stand upon its hind legs like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. If the wings of the lion represent that God had given the kingdom to Nebuchadnezzar, then their removal implies that God no longer approved of the kingdom of Babylon and would remove his protection of the kingdom. Of course, once that happens, it is only a matter of time before it will either fall apart or be conquered by another. No kingdom can stand without Yahuwah's, God's approval, the Creator's approval. Making the lion stand up on its hind legs and giving it a heart of a man suggests that the ruler of Babylon would someday change from being a fierce, courageous power to become a fearful man. Belshazzar certainly must have experienced great fear when he learned that his kingdom was taken from him and given to another. And we saw that in Daniel 5, how his knees, he was so afraid when he saw the handwriting on the wall that his knees smote one against another. That's what it says in the scripture. I mean, his knees literally knocked. He was so afraid. So we see how that picture, how he was given the heart of a man. He turned from a fierce lion into a fearful man. And that's actually what happened. The Medes and the Persians were already outside the gates of Babylon and entered the city later that night. Belshazzar was killed. He had a reason to be afraid because he did, even though, like the scripture says, even though he knew all these things, he still did not fear God. About 20 years before Daniel arrived in Babylon, which is in what is now Iraq, the city of Babylon was originally part of the Assyrian Empire, but it eventually rebelled against Assyria and then turned and engulfed it. Babylon simply took over Assyria, and there was only one kingdom that remained afterwards, which never split into smaller parts. Consequently, it is represented by a lion with one head and no horns, indicating it remained as one kingdom till its end. The lion could not represent Assyria, which no longer existed. The vision concerned kingdoms beginning at the time of Daniel, not before, so Assyria could not be represented by any of these beasts. Prophetic beasts in Daniel always begin with the time of the prophet and move forward from there. So why represent? Why a lion to represent Babylon? Like I said, this goes to the characteristics principles. And let's go into this so we get a little bit more understanding. In the rules of interpretation for Daniel Revelation, there's a rule called the characteristics principle. This rule says that the things on a beast, other than its body, heads, and horns, which are used primarily to indicate the passage of time, and are therefore primary characteristics indicating behaviors of the kingdoms, how they would act, or how they would do certain things. And yeah, we did all this. We went through all these principles yesterday, so I don't see any reason to go through them again. So let's move on to our next scripture reference here. And that would be, he said, "And behold," in chapter 7, verse 5, Daniel continues, "And behold, another beast, a second alike to a bear. And it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth of it, between its teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. So let's take a look at the bear and see if we can just figure out who the bear is. Interpretation principles used. Position and succession of kingdoms and characteristics on the bear. The bear represented the Medo-Persia, which was a kingdom made up of Medes who lived in the northern part of what is today Iran, and Persia, which is the southern part of Iran today. Elam was the third part of this kingdom, but was only a minor player in the kingdom. On the bear, one shoulder, or possibly one paw, depending on the interpretation of the original language, was raised up, indicating one would be dominant over the other, which turned out to be the case. The Medes were dominant initially, but eventually the Persians came to dominate the Medes. The three ribs in the bear's mouth are believed to symbolize the three steps of conquest that Medo-Persia did in creating the empire. The three steps were the conquest of Lydia, Babylonia, and Egypt in that order. And this is a example of the characteristics principle. The three ribs tell us something about what this power would do. So why is a bear used to represent Medo-Persia? To use a bear, the use of a bear to represent Medo-Persia is another example of the use of the characteristics principle. Consider carefully this question. Why have a bear represent Medo-Persia? Why not a pig? How about a hippopotamus? Well, they're not predators. Both are dangerous. The hippo is rated as one of the most dangerous animals in all of Africa because it kills more people than just about any other animal. It has huge teeth and a massive mouth, so if it bites a person, it almost certainly will be fatal. So how about a fox? Well, that is a predator and would look rather cool. But still, there is the question, why use a bear? A bear is a very intelligent predatory animal, generally keeps to itself, but if you get in its way or he thinks that you are a threat to him, look out. He can be really dangerous. The bear tends to claw and bite, particularly on the head, but it may do this anywhere in the body. And when it attacks, it may strike with its paws. Hence, it tends to use brute force when it attacks to maim or kill. The attack method of the bear is clearly reliant upon brute strength. The Persians frequently did, in fact, use this message. There are a number of battles known from history in which the Persians brought huge armies to fight against their enemies. It seems that they figured sheer manpower would do the job, and it usually did. In one battle they had against the Greeks, they claimed that they brought 1 million men with them for the attack. Historians think that the number is exaggerated, but the claim probably was made to suggest that they came in huge numbers prepared for battle. So there may be an element of truth to the claim. This particular attack failed, and they lost the battle, but attacking like this is similar to the way a bear will do, which simply applies brute strength to get the job done, and is usually successful. The characteristic principle applies to the bear because the species itself is telling you something about its behavior, how it will do something, or what it will do. In this case, it is telling you how it will do battle with brute force, and that's its method of attack. So how do we know that the bear represents Medo-Persia? First, in history, it is clear that the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon in 539 or 538 BC. The date depends on the source you read. The most accurate date seems to be the 539 BC. We're only talking a year difference here, so not really a whole lot to quibble about. Second, the context of the vision is that one kingdom follows another. Since Daniel was living under the Babylonian kingdom at the time of the vision, Daniel 7:1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, it shows that the next kingdom to take over the area was clearly Medo-Persia. But some have argued that the explanation part of the vision, the four kingdoms are four kings that shall arise from the earth. in Daniel 7:17. These great beasts, which are four, are four kings which shall arise out of the earth, meaning that the four kingdoms are, in fact, yet future to the time of this vision. This, indeed, while appealing to some, is incorrect. First, the vision parallels the vision given to Nebuchadnezzar of the large statue made of different metals, in which future empires of the region were symbolized by four different body parts, each made of a different metal. In this vision, Nebuchadnezzar is told that he is the head of gold, which means that the vision begins with Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, not some future kingdom. Since the vision of Daniel parallels this dream of Nebuchadnezzar, it must be that the successive kingdoms are one and the same. And we'll pick up here after we get back from this break. You're listening to Cross the Border. That's the name of this program. And my website is crosstheborder.org. How high, how high. Listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Your area has just unexpectedly flooded. The power's out, so is the water, and you are thirsty. But wait, outside, look, there's lots of water, and then you see it.
Oh my gosh! What is that floating in the water? And what is that odor?
No problem. You thought ahead and own a Berkey water purification system. Berkey has revolutionized the way water is purified simply and naturally. Requiring no power, electricity, or water pressure, the powerful black Berkey elements extract pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, chemicals, heavy metals, and other nasties that might be found in flood water. Berkey systems can purify treated water during normal times, and during unexpected emergencies, they can get rid of the unhealthy stuff in raw, untreated water.
For more information on the powerful Berkey line of products, call First Amendment Radio at 559-781-3773 or order on the web at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
You are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. We do not have freedom of speech because the Constitution gives it to us. The constitutional amendment was written to keep the government from taking our freedom away. The Creator gave us our rights, but He also gives us the capacity to do evil or usurp the rights of others. Our individual rights end where the rights of another begin. No one has the right to do evil, because evil can never be right. Those who would seek to limit your right to speak or hear the truth are the same who seek to subjugate, control, and enslave you. Freedom is not free. Support the worldwide First Amendment Radio Network by going to firstamendmentradio.com on the internet and following the instructions there to support us. Thank you for listening. Listening to Cross the Border, and today we're going through the book of Daniel, and we're in chapter 7. We left off, we were talking about the bearer of Daniel's dream vision that he had, so we're going to pick up where we left off. We were talking about, where did we leave off here? Oh yes, the idea that the words in the original language support the idea that the vision is an ongoing process from and including the time of Daniel and continues into the future. Therefore, there's no need to look to the future of Daniel for the beginning of the four kingdoms. They had already begun with Babylon. The kingdom after Babylon was the Medo-Persians, and the next after them was the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, and the final kingdom of the four was the Romans. Some have suggested that the four beasts represent four concurrent kingdoms that existed at that time, but we reject that. So with that, we're gonna move on to the next beast of Daniel's dream vision, and that would be, let's go back to our scriptural reference here and take a look. Okay, we have the lion. We covered the bear, and in verse 6, he says, "After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it." And that's plainly all that Daniel says about it. The leopard. The beast like a leopard had the four wings of a fowl, and it also had four heads. Let's see what we can discover about that. This beast represents Greece or Macedonia. How do we know that it represents Greece or Macedonia? This beast is the third in a series that represented kingdoms that began with Babylon. It is known that Babylon, the lion in the vision, was conquered by the Medes and the Persians, the bear in the vision, who in turn were conquered by Alexander the Great's army, the four-headed leopard in the vision. The sequence of kingdoms tells the story. This changeover from one dominant kingdom to another exemplifies the succession principle. The four wings suggest very rapid conquest. And that's from the what we call the characteristics principle, because the leopard had four wings. That's a characteristic. They occur on the back of the leopard, indicating that they apply to the time represented by the body. Alexander the Great did, in fact, conquer very rapidly, just as the image would suggest. The four heads clearly represent the time of the four divisions of the empire originally created by Alexander the Great. Note the four heads all occur together, indicating the kingdoms also occur together and are to be seen as concurrent with one another. The heads on the body are all leopards, so likewise the original kingdom was Grecian, and the split up of the empire was also Grecian. This one could say that the heads were of a like nature to the body because the heads represented political kingdoms or powers just like the body was, and that we call that the similarity principle. And we discussed all these principles over the last couple days, so this makes a lot of sense. Note that the heads represented smaller, weaker kingdoms, and that's the difference principle. The split up of the kingdom into four parts after the death of Alexander the Great demonstrates the Miller principle, which says that the body of a beast with multiple heads is used to represent the time period of the initial kingdom. Here, the initial kingdom was created by Alexander the Great, and the multiple heads are used to represent the time period or the passage of time, so a time period that of the kingdoms that follow afterwards, which are a result of the breakup or division of power of the initial kingdom. Daniel 8 shows a goat that symbolizes the same thing as a leopard. It says the following about it, and we won't get too far into Daniel 8 because we will get there when we get there. And the rough goat is the king of Greece, the Grecian Empire, the same thing. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, so that would be Alexander the Great. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, and we see the same thing here, the similarity principle. Four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So when we get to Daniel, the next chapter, we realize that we have the same kingdom represented by a goat. So why is a leopard used to represent Greece? After all, God could have used a giant boa constrictor, maybe a hyena. A hyena has some of the most powerful jaws to territorial kingdom, so it surely would be seen as a strong, fierce, cunning predator, but instead a leopard was used. As a predator, a leopard has to be very smart to survive. It is fast, stealthy, and sneaks up on its prey and then suddenly pounces on it. Sometimes it will hide in a tree and wait for the unsuspecting prey to come by underneath, and it will drop down upon it and kill it. It uses its claws to hold the prey under control and subdue it, then grasps the throat of the victim and with its sharp teeth to suffocate it, thereby attacking the most vulnerable exposed part of the body of its prey. Death usually comes relatively rapidly this way. Sometimes it will kill by biting the back of the neck with the intent of breaking the neck. After the prey is dead, it will tear it to shreds and consume it. This is comparable to Alexander the Great, who was a very smart general and possessed all of the characteristics, which shows that the characteristics of the beast do tell us something about the behavior of a power or what a power would do, which is embodied in the characteristics principle. So as you can see, the first king, Alexander the Great, is broken off. He dies, and four come up after him. In history, when Alexander the Great died, his half-brother took the throne. Consequently, there was a second king in this empire, but he was mentally unstable and considered unfit to rule. So military generals fought each other for the kingdom, but finally divided it and parted ways. There were seven top military commanders of Alexander the Great who initially fought among themselves for the empire, but in the end, only four got anything. So we'll move on from there. that's enough detail on that. If you do a search, you can find a lot of these things out for yourself. So let's move on to the fourth beast. Daniel continues, and in verse 7 of chapter 7, "And after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all of the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Very interesting. We aren't told what kind of beast this is, but it was different from all of those before it, so we get a lot of characteristics here. And it was dreadful and terrible, and that's the kind of beast it was. It wasn't a leopard, it wasn't a lion, it wasn't a bear, but it was dreadful and terrible. So let's see if we can use the principles that we discussed yesterday and the day before to figure out who this beast was and what it was. And also, we have history. We already know who the beast is. So, why is a dreadful-looking beast used to represent Rome, pagan Rome? Consider that many other beasts could have been used, maybe an elephant. Yet that is not what is done so far as we know. Why is this animal without a species name? Consider that the description of the beast is another example of the characteristics principle being applied. This beast is said to devour and crush and stamp what was left with its feet, and also, which was different from all of them, very frightening, whose teeth were of iron and its nails bronze. This describes its behavior, what it would do when it was attacked. You might say, this is a description of its method of attack. Rome did have a policy that it would respond with overwhelming force against any rebellion, and it tended to do this very well. Of course, it was much more successful in doing this than the Persians were, but its troop training and battle equipment was superior to that of the Persians. The important point is that its behavior was described quite accurately by the description of the beast itself. It could indeed devour and crush its enemies with those iron teeth. Rome was known for its use of iron weapons, which gave it an edge over its enemy. Stamping on its enemy with its feet, with feet that had brass claws perhaps, is a reference to its tendency to completely destroy any opposition by smashing it totally. The fact that it was not given a species name, but was described as very frightening, again tells us something about its behavior. It would seem that something that is frightening like this would be very intimidating. And history bears out that Rome was very intimidating to the nations it conquered. For example, in 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes IV was in the process of invading Egypt. He was met by a representative of the Roman Senate who informed Antiochus Epiphanes that the Romans were demanding that he withdraw from Egypt, then drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes and told him not to leave it until he made up his mind to cease the invasion and leave Egypt. History records that he stopped the invasion of Egypt and went home to Syria. The danger posed by Rome must have been quite frightening, for this man simply withdrew without a fight against the Romans and ran home. You can be sure it was quite difficult for him to accept this, because he had gone through all the expense and difficulties of an invasion of Egypt, and yet he left. Hence, this prophecy of Rome as a dangerous and frightening power was clearly fulfilled in this and many other incidents. Daniel was also told that this beast would be different than all before it. What did this mean? How was it different than all before it? The others had one thing in common, which is all of them were ruled by kings. But Rome did not share that characteristic with them because Rome experimented with six different forms of government before it broke up in 476 AD. If you think carefully about this, notice that God had not said anything about the form of governments of the previous kingdoms. He was silent, almost as if he had this unwritten rule about the other kingdoms. But with this one, he changes the rule and only then notifies you of his existence by informing you that it was being changed. The statement that the fourth dreadful beast is diverse from all those who went before it is an example of the exception principle being applied, which means that whatever rule was in effect up until the exception is stated is now obsolete, and the new rule takes place from this point on for this power. And I hope the pieces are coming together for you as they are for me, especially when we consider that the Roman Empire that began with this great and terrible beast, even though it split up in time, as we see from the heads and the horns, that still the body is Roman. And we see this in even the land where I live in America, which has Roman-style governments throughout the land. So we see that this beast, which is represented by the body, is now being broken up, but still the characteristics exist even today. And they exist over the whole earth. Another aspect of this kingdom that made it different than those that went before it was that it conquered most of Europe. Previous kingdoms did not succeed in doing that for various reasons. Babylon never approached Europe. The Persians tried to take over Europe but were stopped by the Greeks. The Greeks seem to have gone from Greece eastward all the way to India, but apparently did not go west or north into Europe, though some recent discoveries suggest they may have planted colonies on mainland Italy. So Rome was different in this aspect from the beginning. Again, this reflects the use of the characteristics principle. The beast evidently had one head with iron teeth. The Bible only mentions the iron teeth, so it seems reasonable that there is a head. So it does not mention two or more heads, and teeth without a head would look ridiculous. It originally had 10 horns, but after them, another horn came up. Horns coming up after other previously existing horns, another form of the Miller principle, which this other horn that came up after, it had a mouth and eyes like a man and spoke great words against God. We'll refer to this horn that talked as the talking horn because of its behavior. Some people refer to it as the little horn power, which is the same thing. This new talking horn was responsible for uprooting 3 of the original 10 horns. The author shows, you can see where they broke off. Okay, yeah, we talked about that. Rome was known as a particularly cruel empire, but it also created a peace that had not existed before then, something that many businessmen no doubt appreciated. Because Rome had a policy that it would respond with overwhelming force against any rebellion, that sounds like America, maybe thinking of the Civil War, perhaps. Very Roman, isn't it? And talk about overwhelming response. It was no civil war, I'll tell you. There was nothing civil about it. It was more like the Roman crush and grinding and stamping the residue with its feet, was it not? Okay, because Rome had a policy that would respond with overwhelming force against any rebellion, it forced a peace among the peoples it governed. Because of the peace that Rome forced into the region, and because of a more reasonable justice system with laws better than any other countries, many people respected Rome. Several kingdoms were in fact quietly handed over to Rome because of this. For example, the Attalid Empire, centered in Pergamum, was willed by its last king to Rome in 133 BC. Bithynia was also willed to Rome in 75 or 74 BC when its last king died. Another history. Okay. Pergamum, the capital of the Attalid Empire, is near the northwest seacoast of Asia Minor, just to the south across the strait from an area once known as Thrace. And we won't get into those details, but you get the idea of the peace that Rome brought. Rome also conquered the remnants of the Greek empires that came up out of the empire of Alexander the Great. This conquest of the Greek empires began when Rome took Asia Minor away from the Seleucid Empire in 188 BC. But this was only the first step and did not do away with any of the three remaining Greek empires that resulted from the split of Alexander the Great's empire. So we get the idea that Rome was this fourth beast and the characteristic principles in Rome. In 31 BC, the Roman general Octavian defeated the Ptolemy Empire in the naval battle of Actium, and it goes on. In 30 BC, he attacked Alexandria. Mark Antony and Cleopatra committed suicide, and Egypt became another province of Rome, and on it goes. So we learned that Rome lived up to the characteristics from Daniel's dream vision. Now, the talking horn. Let's go to the talking horn. And who is it? This is very interesting. The horn with the mouth and the eyes that spoke against God has been believed by many to represent the papacy, which certainly got legal powers it did not have after the date historians note as the end of the Roman Empire, 476 AD. So as he came up afterwards and three fell before it. The papacy certainly existed before the fall of Rome, but to be sure, the symbol of the horn coming up after the other ten horns began to have their day of power is trying to show us that the time when it has legal power to work against God is what is represented here, which began in 538 AD. It is not trying to show us that it existed only after 476 AD, for it certainly did exist before then. To understand exactly what happened in 538 AD that makes it significant, the reader needs to know some history and basic facts of government. These facts of government are as follows. 1. Decrees or laws issued by a government are only applicable to territory they control. So if you don't control a territory, you cannot apply laws there as they are unenforceable. 2. Even if you reside and control a territory, you cannot control another territory unless you back it up by force of arms. And 3. To be able to communicate with that other territory, both of these factors must exist for government to be able to enforce law upon any given territory. So with these facts in mind, the papal power over other bishops and the power to punish heresy was given to the Pope as a matter of legal right in the spring of 538 AD, after Justinian's general Belisarius managed to break the siege of Rome by the Ostrogoths, which lasted from March 537 to March 538. Belisarius first entered Rome in December 536 when the Ostrogoths abandoned Rome as he entered it. But he had to immediately begin preparations for a siege that he knew was coming and facing an enemy with probably 10 times as many troops. This would leave him little time for setting up and running Roman law administration. So consequently, it is extremely probable that he did not get that done. Once the siege began, virtually nobody could leave the city. So any laws that Justinian had made that were to be generally applicable and enforceable outside the city by the Pope or anyone else were simply not enforceable. And we're going to have to continue here after the break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Cross the Border. And do visit my website, crosstheborder.org. I would like to hear from you, so send me an email.